Welcome to The Sit Down. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. The Sit Down is the latest addition to our Raging Chicken Radio podcast. On The Sit Down, we talk with activists, public intellectuals, investigative journalists, and rabble-rousers of all sorts to deepen our discussions and prepare us for the struggles ahead. Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. Check out all our citizen journalism at ragingchickenpress.org. You can subscribe to Raging Chicken Radio on Podbean, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and iTunes. Subscribing to Raging Chicken Radio is one of the easiest things that you can do to help support this podcast and all the work we do with Raging Chicken. If you want to help build a progressive activist media network for PA and beyond, you can become a member for as little as $2 a month. That's less than the cost of a beer or a cup of coffee, folks. Come on. Just go to RagingChickenPress.org and click Become a Member under the Support and Membership tab. Or, if you're listening on Podbean, there's that nice green button right at the top that says Become a Patron and you'll be on your way. Be sure to check out all the thank you gifts from each membership level while you're there. All right, so today on The Sit Down, I'm totally psyched to once again to be able to do in-person interview instead of sitting in my little hole in the basement doing kind of internet discussions. Today we're welcoming Colleen Clemons, Dr. Colleen Clemons, folks. We'll be talking gender at the Olympics, feministing in higher education, and the election. So Colleen Clemons is Associate Professor of Non-Western Literatures at Kutztown University of Pennsylvania. Yes, that's right. Same place that I teach, right in my department, right around the corner. She earned her PhD in postcolonial literature at Lehigh University. She earned her MED in English education at DeSales University while teaching 12th grade English in the public system. Her academic work has been published in Feminist Foundations and Journal of Postcolonial Writing. She serves as the academic consultant for Gale's Contemporary Literary Criticism series, where she focuses on postcolonial writing. She reviews novels by postcolonial authors for Mosaic Magazine and World Literature Today, and scholarly text about world issues and American culture for the Journal of American Culture. Among her creative endeavors, she is the editor of several books of nonfiction, including Philadelphia Reflections, Stories from the Delaware to the Schuylkill, and has published short essays on various collections, including Click, When We Knew We Were Feminist. On the web, she's a staff writer for Bitch Flicks, where she writes about issues of gender in popular films. She has also published pieces on Scary Mommy, Literary Mama, and Feministing. Colleen is an educational expert from Noodle.com, where she writes about diversity in literature and writing. She lives in Bucks County with her partner, two dogs, and daughter. And she can be reached on her blog. And Colleen, what's your blog? Want to plug your blog right here?
KU Poco on WordPress.
KU Poco. Welcome, Colleen.
Thank you
for joining me today.
I'm so happy to be here.
Well, here we are once again. We have a hot, steamy summer day. So, and we're what, 2 weeks out, less than 2 weeks out from the beginning of the semester. How are you holding up?
Doing okay. Keep reminding myself that I still have more time off than most people in America. So,
yeah.
You know.
Well, that's for sure.
Right?
That's absolutely for sure. And I think that's one of the good things. I remember Stanley Aronowitz years ago wrote about higher education being a faculty member as the last best job in America because you had control over your time to a
yes.
certain degree.
Crucial. Yes.
So crazy. So I understand now that you've made a bit of a splash here. Let everybody know a little bit about what you've been doing this summer. You've been watching some of the Olympics.
I have, when I have had time, been watching some of the Olympics when I'm not reading about the stupid things people are saying about the Olympics.
Yes. Twitter. You got to love Twitter for that.
Yes.
Well, you recently had this piece published in Teaching Tolerance, and it's kind of an open letter to the Olympic media. It's the Olympic media, dear Olympic media, do better by women athletes. And you kind of draw attention to the way that women have been covered and the way that kind of gender is being dealt with here in this coverage of the film. So talk us a little bit through kind of what you're seeing here.
So what I did in that piece is used that the headline about Michael Phelps and Ledecky, I can't remember her first name, which is Katie
Ledecky, yep.
Where she was literally marginalized into the bottom of the headline, and Michael Phelps coming in second was the major headline, and she breaking a world record was the secondary idea, and use that as a metaphor to talk about this open letter idea of talking to the media, telling them that they were not doing a good job. And I think because everybody seems to be talking about this, I feel like this Olympics is the first Olympics where everybody is talking about
this. I agree, yeah.
I don't know if it's because social media is doing a better job. I'm not sure. But I feel like part of me feels a little bit affirmed because I feel like I've been saying a lot of these things for years and suddenly people are really noticing. So that open letter was demanding that they do better because this marginalization is being watched by so many people. So for example, in there I talk about the gymnast whose medal ceremony was delayed so we could all watch another swimmer.
Simone Biles, Simone Manuel. Yes. Yeah.
So the idea that her accomplishment was, again, marginalized. So I was just really pointing out all these moments of marginalization of women as if their accomplishments didn't matter as much. Or when they did accomplish something, it was to the credit of some man or the fact that she managed to do this and be a mother. There have been many articles about how these women are doing this and mothering, and I've yet to see an article about there are these men doing this and fathering. So all this media attention that's been given to women seems to focus on their identity as opposed to their accomplishments. And that's really what I was trying to point out was, for that day, let them be an athlete. And this is what athletes have been asking for too, is just pay attention to my achievement. You don't need everything else. Like, I can mother and be an athlete, but for today, let's just talk about the fact that I broke this record or won this medal instead of complicating the identity of the person.
Exactly. And one of the things that I think it was fitting that you publish this in Teaching Tolerance, right? Because in a sense, what you suggest all throughout this article is that you're teaching gender right now by the way that you're covering these Olympics,
yes.
Right? And you say that, look, you know, our daughters, our sons, our nieces, our nephews,
yes.
And us, we are all watching how this is being covered. So when we actually, you know, bump like a gold medal gymnast, right, to like, you know, late night TV or kind of the YouTube in order to kind of be able to watch it, we're saying something about what we're privileging. And that, you know, and I would encourage everybody, we're going to put a link in the show notes directly to Colleen's article. And in that, she has the actual clip from the AP article, right? Where, you know, it says Phelps ties for silver in 100 fly, okay? Number one, he ties. Number two, it's silver, okay? Under that, in smaller type, is Ledecky sets world record in women's 800 freestyle. Right. If you know anything about what's ever about newspapers, when people pick that up, they look at those big headlines first. Right. So there's a good chance that anybody who looked up and picked up a newspaper and saw that headline didn't even see anything about Ledecky or assumed that Ledecky might not even be an American. Right. Because then she's
and on social media, a lot of people have been making the argument to me that Phelps is the bigger story and Phelps sells newspapers. And my response has been, that's what misogyny is. You know, that's sexist, right? That privileging of him over her because he sells and she doesn't is
right.
Exactly the point I'm making. So when people keep making that point to me, my reply is continues to be, you are making my point when you say that to me. If Ledecky's accomplishments don't sell papers and Michael Phelps's less than performance in that moment does sell papers, therein lies the structural problem that I am trying to point out to you.
Exactly.
So there's been some backlash of, you know, that I've been getting that a lot. And then the piece that I will publish too, and that's more focused on race. I've been hearing a lot of, well, this is just the way it is. And my response continues to be, it doesn't need to be this way. And that we are, like you just said, we're teaching gender. Yeah, I don't let my daughter watch TV a lot, but I let her watch the Olympics. She's four. What you choose, like I say in the piece, the editorial choices you make are what is reifying, or I argue could dismantle our ideas of these gender norms. So yeah, I think I say in the end, like, sports needs to do a better job because it translates into a much larger idea. So, and that's the other thing people say, well, it's just sports. It's just how we're talking about sports. And I'm like, sports matter.
Absolutely.
The whole world stops for the Super Bowl. And that's why I say in the beginning of the piece, the whole world stops for the Olympics. More people watch TV than normally would. Like I said, my daughter, like, kids watch this. We're all watching. So we're all watching and we're hearing people say these off-base remarks about women. And that's the point I'm making there. Like, we know how to talk about elite athletes. male elite athletes,
right.
You all commentators, you know how to talk about them, but you have some serious work to do if you're not talking about that kind of hegemonic population that has dominated sport, that has dominated covers of Sports Illustrated 4.9, not including the swimsuit issue, but from 2000 to 2011, 4.9% of the covers had women on them. Not including that one issue a year. But, right, I mean, that editorial choice is very clear to me. That is very clear to me that that is a problem.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was interesting. I was listening to one of the podcasts I'll listen to on a regular basis is Bitch Media Podcast.
Yes, right? Love it. And they did a sports one.
And Capitalism,
yes,
right?
They
and
they did a sports
one. I thought that was a fantastic episode where kind of drawing attention to exactly, so we hit some of the limits when, on the one hand, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, you see, especially in the kind of the academy now, but in kind of broader kind of political justice circles right now, we talk about intersectionality.
Yes, right? That was what my piece today that I wrote was
about. Well, here we have it. Well, it's a little preview.
It's not published yet, but yes, it was all about intersectionality.
Well, and that's exactly that. When we see this, we see these examples when somebody says something like, well, like we focus more on felt because that's what sells newspapers.
Yeah.
There's the, exactly, you've just told us what the problem is, right? And what I thought was interesting, though, about this Olympics in per se, right, and not to overstate where we are, right, to kind of move into some sort of Olympic glory moment, but is that, you know, I think about the U.S. women's soccer team.
Yes.
Right? And what they've drawn attention to in terms of parity and pay.
Yes, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. Equal pay for equal work. And so the argument, again, on social media that I got given back to me was, well, they don't generate as much money. And my response was, the law is equal pay for equal work. And we all need to show up at these games. We need to participate in them. And they have done so much.
Well, and I
think they're like activists, like the turf
issue,
the pay issue.
Exactly.
They have been incredible activists within sports.
They're amazing. And I think that it goes right back to this, you know, to that notion where, well, what if we had a Title IX for media? Right? It's like the reason, no, like you think
no,
about, right?
I offer my services to them in a parenthetical.
Like,
I will happy to consult with you if you need some tips for winter. Yeah.
But that's exactly it. The whole principle behind Title IX, right? Is that there's, okay, if you want to make an argument that, you know, women aren't as involved in sports, right? Well, Title IX recognizes, well, perhaps that's because the opportunities are not there for women to be involved.
There's a material reason behind that.
Exactly.
Yes.
Same thing with media coverage, right?
Yes.
If you start covering women's sports as you cover men's sports, right? Yeah, it might be true in the short term, given our current conditions, right? There's going to be a gap in terms of revenue and all this and all fans and all this. But even now, as the U.S. women's soccer team has made such a splash globally, right? This, that when they won that gold medal, it was the most watched like sports thing
and
in
they
history,
were on the cover,
right? And they were,
and
on,
they
the
were
cover,
on the cover,
right? That's
but
that,
remember, that she was policed for taking off her shirt.
That's right.
Right? There's always that element of policing.
Yep.
That's what I'm talking about. There's always that element of like, well, they won, but. They won, but she took her shirt off.
Mm-hmm.
You brought up intersectionality, and that's what I was writing about this morning. I was writing about the bullying of Gabby Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read about that at all?
No,
so
no,
Gabby Douglas didn't put her hand on the heart. Her heart for the national anthem, which I was actually taught not to do either.
Hmm.
So, and got completely bullied, was called unpatriotic, said she was undeserving. So I put on social media just to draw attention to that, not knowing. I said, imagine if Michael Phelps didn't put his hand to the heart. No one would care. No one would bully him. No one would point it out. And then I got my traditional element, you know, level of backlash. And then one of my friends on social media told me about Michael Phelps laughing. I did not know this. Okay. So Michael Phelps laughed during the national anthem. Guffawed. Not just like tee-heed, like guffawed. You can find video of him. And all the coverage of it, the article that I drafted this morning, is Times coverage of it saying, when you find out the reason for him doing this, it's going to make you smile. So here's Gabby Douglas, right? And talk about intersectionality. Black, female, and here's Michael Phelps, right? White, male. and how they do, and I talk about in this piece about when you want to teach about intersectionality, you want to have the most parallel possible situations mm-hmm. to compare so that students can take that and make observations. This happened within hours of each other. So here's Gabby Douglas being trolled and bullied, and like there's terrible hashtags. Her mother's telling the media that, you know, they're really suffering. Gabby has to apologize. And here's Michael Phelps. Nobody even notices that he was laughing. And I don't care about either of those. I want to be clear. I don't care if you laugh during the national anthem. I don't care if you cover your heart. I'm not interested in call-out culture, mm-hmm. right? That is a moment that I don't understand the level of composure that is required. So when I'm talking about, what I find myself talking about a lot is how other people talk about things.
Yep, yep, yep.
And so, it's unfortunate that it's Michael Phelps again, but I think there's a reason for that because of what you were just talking about. Everything is Michael Phelps, right? Every single thing is all about...
He's branded already.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And he's had his tribulations, and he's overcome them. I understand he's a great sports story. But, like, no one's talking about the fact that he's a father.
Haven't heard one mention of that.
I saw one mention of it on a funny tweet that was joking about how father, wife, or husband of blank and father of blank manages to win 200 free or something. Like, took it and flipped it.
But flipped it, right?
But no one's talking about this. No one's talking about how he manages to be a father and... And so I just felt like that moment was such a perfect way to talk about intersectionality in the Olympics. Within hours of each other, these things are happening. And how we are so willing to bash a young black woman. And we are so willing to forget. The picture that I found from a media source was, what's so funny, Phelpsy? As if he's some cute, endearing rapscallion. Right. He's like Opie from the Andy Griffith Show. And so he's the boy next door. And when somebody does a similar thing, and I honestly, like, not putting your hand over your heart versus laughing, it seems like laughing is probably the more disrespectful thing there.
Yeah.
So, I looked on the internet to see if anybody was upset about this. Again, I don't think they should be about the laughing, but...
No, but you look
nothing.
For parallels,
there was
right?
nothing.
Exactly.
There was no corollary. There was no analog to the Gabby Douglas.
Well, and what's interesting about that, too, as well, is that, you know, in kind of in my head, right, because I think about, okay, how can you meme this, right? So if you want to do Michael Phelps, that he's laughing on the podium, that would be the easiest meme in the world. It would be Michael Phelps, stoned again?
Right?
Right.
Nobody
but
did that.
But none of that, right? Because that would be, oh my God, that's anti-American. You're going after this guy. But the angry black girl.
Yes.
Right?
Well, and that she was, okay, so, and that is absolutely, so it had, there was if you don't like America, get out. You should be glad you can compete for America. I think it was the anniversary of Michael Brown's death, and there was something about that. Like she just didn't put her hand on her heart.
Right.
That's
right.
It. It wasn't that she was raising her... Again, fine that he did that, raise his arm in black power salute. Like, she wasn't doing anything like that. She was just standing there. And her just standing there is a body to be policed.
Yep.
And commented on. And he... That's the definition of privilege, right? Like, that he can move one way through the world, and she is moving through the world in a completely different way. And that's what has been so exciting about these Olympics, because
exactly.
People are talking about it, and it's so easy to find information. It's been, like I say in that line, honestly, I'm not joking, I've spent more time reading about what people are saying about the Olympics than I've had time to watch them, which is unfortunate, but... That's okay. That's what I do.
Well, you know, one of the things about any event like this, and this is again going back to the Bitch Media podcast, is one of the things that was fascinating about that one too, and I thought it was a really good point. I forget the guy who was they had on, who was one of the author of the Power Games, I think is what it was called, the book. I'm not sure, but in that discussion, they were talking about the ways that the Olympics becomes occasions, political occasions, right, to have some of these discussions. And mm-hmm. it was a really interesting, reminder that politics has always been interwoven, right, in the Olympic Games, and in part because it's one of the few opportunities we have as a global stage to kind of see these things play out. And it's also interesting that, you know, every 4 years we get these markers to see, well, what's transpired between one time and the next. Like, so for example, the other big story at the Olympics right now has to do around
Caster
Semenya and Dutee Chand, right? Mm-hmm. About questions about whether they're really women competing in this, right? And I'm thinking this was an issue in the last Olympics as well.
The New Yorker, so in 2009 or 2010, the New Yorker ran a profile about Semenya running.
Yep.
So they did a whole profile on her. This was an issue before, and this is before we were getting good about talking about trans issues.
Exactly.
I mean, this was before people, this was part of the verbiage and lexicon of ordinary life. But anyway, go ahead. Yeah.
That's exactly it, right? And so since that Olympics, right, that we've had all sorts of discussions about trans. We've had Bruce Jenner, for Christ's sake, right?
Oh, good point, yeah.
Right? You know what I mean? It's like
the quintessence of Olympian, yeah,
right, which in some ways, we could, I'm sure, go on for hours about the complications around that, right?
Yes.
So Bruce Jenner moving to Caitlyn Jenner and kind of all the stuff.
I've written about it.
Yeah.
Well, if you go to my blog, you can read about it.
I've actually read that, yeah. But so in some ways that kind of inserts kind of the whole trans issue into the kind of Olympic discussion. Now, it should be clear that we're talking about two different things here, right? As I've seen it as of yet, there's been no discussion that she's actual trans.
She's
right?
not.
It has to do
right.
right.
I've not seen anything where
right.
yes.
So that's but it has
so
more
it's
to
all
do
about
with
biology.
Right. right. It has more to do with how we talk about gender.
Yes.
And I think that whole discussion around the trans debate has helped open up a discussion of gender, which says this is not a simple binary. Right. That we have
not.
To think about these. You know, and it was funny as I was reading some of the. Well, one of the ways I always talk with my son and my daughter about boys and girls,
yes,
right?
Because they're very, our children are the same age.
Right, exactly.
So we both know
right,
what
exactly.
they're doing. Yeah.
And so, you know, we talk about, you know, why you shouldn't hit each other, right? But also why boys shouldn't hit girls, right?
Yes.
But Rowan, my son, he's very heady. He always thinks about every counter argument that's possibly out there. So he thinks about the strong girls, right? Mm-hmm. That beat up on the boys, mm-hmm. right?
Which is not okay.
Right? No, which
right.
is also
yes.
not okay.
Yes.
Right? But it's that occasion to think very carefully about how you talk about gender, right? Because mm-hmm. it's not just like boys are stronger than girls, because mm-hmm. that's not true.
Right?
It has to do with a bigger question, or it has to do with, you know, again, having a discussion with a 7-year-old about sexual violence, right, and about rape and oppression and things like that. You know, you take it in kids' terms,
yes.
right? But it also, this Olympics got me thinking about those terms too as well, is like, even things like that, right? So, well, boys, girls. Well, no, not so much, right? Even the way that we talk about, and I can't remember where I saw this, it was some discussion that I would found myself involved in,
yeah.
and they were talking about even talking with children about relationships, right? You know, who they like.
Yeah.
And I found myself, you know, I said, oh, it's interesting because I've always thought about when I talk with Rowan or Scout, right? You know, they say, well, who are you going to like, right? It's not like, oh, is that girl like you? I would say, maybe someday you're going to find the love of your life, right?
Yeah.
Which becomes this open thing. And it seems like in this Olympics, there's an opening of discourse around gender that I cannot recall ever seeing in the Olympic Games, at least.
And the backlash of it is the anxiety
exactly.
that we see in the commentators squeezing really hard to the heteronormative idea of parenting, mothering. You know, it's like they don't have any other language to talk about this.
Yep.
So yes, everybody else I think is doing a great job. I think we're having really good conversations because suddenly we're forced to. We're suddenly thinking about biology. You know, we're thinking about sex and gender as different things
yep.
in our everyday, well, you know, to some degree, but in our everyday conversations with Ev, with my daughter, you know, I think she knows the difference between the parts. We don't talk about hormones and all those things, but
yeah.
the sometimes the parts don't match the feelings. And, you know, that's how we talk about it in our house. But I think what we're seeing perhaps is this kind of last, in the coverage of the Olympics, is this last gasp of clinging to this kind of anxious reaction to that. This anxious reaction to... So maybe I make this article about, or I wrote a piece about Donald Trump where I make this argument that he's actually a really great sign because he's this like last gasp hold on binaries. So maybe that's what we're seeing. Maybe the Olympics is the same thing. We have these tone deaf people making comments about families, right? About the gymnast Simone, is it Biles or Biles? I don't know.
Biles, I think.
Biles. Yeah, I think. That her parents aren't her parents, right? Because only one, because families can only look one way, right? These kind of one idea, all, everything fits, isn't, those rhetorics and narratives aren't fitting the Olympics anymore.
Right.
Because we have opened up all these spaces for families to look different, for competition to look different, right? I mean, we see women from countries that weren't allowed to compete. We see women participating in hijab. We see women participating in other veiling. These are exciting moments to me.
Yeah, I agree.
And we see a refugee team. Mm-hmm. Now, I wish we cared as much about refugees as we do the refugee team. That's a podcast for another day. But still, maybe that's how we start talking finally about refugees. Maybe that's the thing that finally gets everybody really talking about the plight of these people. So... It has been really cool. Like, I know I've been really down on it in some ways, but I think it's because it is a turning point. I feel like we're just, again, we're like at that tipping point where things are really starting to turn, and it's just so exciting. It's so exciting for me as somebody who's been teaching for 20 years to see the differences in ways students talk about these things. I mean, it's just... It warms my heart in a way that nothing else does. So maybe I should be looking at this as a really positive, that, you know, my open letter is a positive call, because what I'm asking them to do is do better.
Right.
I'm asking them to do better for the sake of everybody. And I really, really mean that.
Well, and I think this is one of these opportunities where you see, in my mind, it's like you see culture outpacing politics and capitalism.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And you know, in some ways, this is where culture and the culture shifts that we've been seeing are really having a kind of dramatic impact. The fact that you have some commentators, certainly not all, right, especially the commentator who was calling the USA for against Brazil women's beach volleyball thing the other night, who referred to women sweating as glittering, right?
I mean, I want to throw stuff at my TV when I hear that stuff.
No, it's remarkable. But when you see that kind of stuff, and you see that there's a lot of the commentators are kind of struggling for how to talk about this stuff, because they recognize if they actually say certain things that they're going to offend their audience, right? And it's going to actually be a problem.
Right.
So they're walking this line, and I think that's a good sign.
And well, that's why I started my piece with saying, I get this is hard.
Yeah.
You have to talk a lot. You're going to say things that aren't really smart sometimes, because to commentate of hours and hours is not easy.
Although I have to say, I think Bob Costas does this all the time anyway. So just he talks
and
nonstop
so does Al Traffic
about ridiculous. Yes.
No, I know. But I did want to honor the fact that, like, if I had to talk that much, I would say really dumb things every now and then. I get it. I get that the job is hard.
Right.
But I don't think anybody's asking those people who are in those positions of power to really think about it. I honestly believe that if they just had somebody sit down and talk to them about gender and about why language matters, they could do better.
I think so, too.
I don't think they're being asked of it. And that's why I wrote it that way. Like, I mean it. I want you to sit down and really think about these issues so you can speak better. Because I understand that you know how to talk about LeBron James. And I know you know how to talk about Michael Phelps. But at this point, because the culture is ahead of you, you are going to have to learn how to talk about other people.
Yep, exactly.
This is the world we live in now. Perhaps it's because of globalization. I'm not sure, but you got to figure out how to do it. Don't make comments that make the rest of us, like, glittering, right? Like, you know, your wife is not a feminist scholar, right? But she looks up and goes, no.
Really? Right.
Right. It's not on her mind all the time like it is.
And our move, right. And our move was, what did we do after that? We said, oh, we had enough of this. We shut off the TV.
And that's what I do. I turn it off.
Yep.
That's exactly what these folks don't want. They don't want me to turn it off.
Yep.
They want me to keep it on. And that might mean you have to challenge people a little tiny bit. But we can handle it. As our culture is showing, we can handle it for the most part.
Yeah, I found myself, this is, you know, one of the things, and before we kind of come up for the break, because I have a couple things I want to say before this, one of the things I thought that, you know, would be kind of a real cool political action, right, would be to do live commentary to the Olympics, right, alongside the Olympics that was being broadcast.
Like
that,
a Mystery Science Theater
kind
to
of,
the Olympics.
Yeah, right?
Yeah,
except
I love that.
You can actually do, with all live streaming and everything like this, yeah, right, you could do this. So it actually, people could listen into the, you know, to the live stream and, yeah, turn off the sound on their TV and have oppositional commentary to what's going on.
So not a commentary on the commentary.
No,
but your own comment, like, right, a feminist scholar, like, commentating, right, on it as,
right,
opposed to.
And I thought that, you know, imagine that if you had, even if it, you know, obviously that would be a huge endeavor to do it for the entire Olympic Games, but if you took particular moments, particular key moments, and then did that as a political intervention in terms,
that's
of,
cool,
of discourse and language, I think it'd be, yeah, kind of really interesting. But one of the things I want to go back to, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about, you know, feministing in higher education,
yeah,
right? And going back to something that you said, and I was just pushing back on someone else earlier today about students, right? There's this narrative out there about students and young folks as kind of not caring, as not being engaged, and all this, yeah, other kind of stuff. And I just don't
that
find that.
That is incredibly far from the truth.
I agree.
Experience.
And so, yeah, I want to, so when we come back from the break, I want to kind of get into that a little bit. And then we're going to close out the day with a little talk on the elections,
yes,
later on, which
sounds
should be
great.
Fun. All right. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be back right after this break. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 5 years, we've brought unapologetic progressive activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism, and frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a good beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support, and keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's The Sit Down. I'm here today once again, right, as you've been listening in, with Colleen Clemens. Colleen Clemens is an associate professor at Kutztown University. And we're talking all things gender today. We just got done talking a little about the Olympics. And the point we got to right before the break was just basically how engaged students are with a lot of the questions. You know, I would say a broad range of questions right now. But I think, especially when it comes to questions of gender, I think we see a level of, say, consciousness and engagement that is, I don't want to, again, go Olympic gold on this, but you know what,
right,
I mean?
Yeah.
But it's kind of historic in a certain way, right? In terms of how they're talking about it. So when you're kind of engaged with students and you say that you're so excited to see them engaged in it, what are the kinds of things that you're seeing on campuses?
So what I'm seeing specifically with being part of the Women's and Gender Studies program and now being the director and advising students, what I'm seeing is them already coming to me with a vocabulary that I used to have to give them.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm seeing on the first day when I teach Introduction to Women's and Gender Studies, I introduce the ideas of gender identity, sexuality, sex, you know, how those aren't the same things. And I give them, it's the gender bred person, which,
mm-hmm,
I know is controversial, but it's an easy entry point,
mm-hmm,
into the conversation. And they're very willing to accept that those are different things.
Mm-hmm.
When I was growing up, those were all conflated. And they are willing to see in a way that I feel like students are so less devoted to binaries than when I was growing up.
I think that's true.
And I think that has something to do with the fluidity of borders. I think that has something to do with the conversations I've been having in classrooms for 20 years.
Yep.
I think that has something to do with the way our generation is parenting. But they are so less committed to that tenacious concept of it is or it isn't, and the idea of gray. Now, it takes some work, but I just feel like they're to a place. You know, I don't have to explain to my classes why fag is not an insult.
Right.
And I apologize for using that word. But when I first started teaching in 1996, that was the only thing that got you detention in my class. Is if I heard you use that slur, you just got detention. No questions asked. I told them on the first
period
day.
Period. Done.
It was, and I didn't give detention for anything. But I was just like, you need to know very quickly that is not going to be okay in here. And in 1996, that was harsh. That was part of the common vocabulary, or pussy, calling somebody a pussy. And I would have to, I think disrupting conversations over and over. I used to play floor hockey, and you know, somebody, it was mostly men, and they'd call each other pussy, and I'd be like, no. Stop it. Like, just, and not being mean, but just like, stop doing that. That is so incredibly offensive. And I think all you need to do is explain to people why it's offensive. And then they're like, oh, I never thought of that. I get a lot of that. I get a lot of, I never thought of it that way. And I don't think people, I think some people are using that language to be hurtful, but I think most people are not. And it's relatively easy to disrupt when you can just say, no. Please stop saying that, and here is why. And they do. So, tranny, right? That used to be another thing when I was growing up, that people would say, tranny. These are not things that I hear students saying in the hallways. I hear a lot of things students say in the hallways. but these are not things I hear anymore. And I think it is because that fluidity is so ever present, I think, in their existences, right? The rich and poor is so blurry, right? The middle class is blurry now. Your nationality is blurry now. It's not insider outsider anymore. And I think all those binaries starting to implode on themselves has again caused a lot of anxiety. But at the same time has brought students to me that I think are willing to talk in ways that weren't always willing to talk in ways that I wanted them to. So I am very hopeful, in at least from a gender perspective, and even the fact that we've added gender to the, it used to be the women's studies minor, right? And now it's the women's and gender studies minor, because we do think, I am committed to investigating the idea of gender. I want to investigate masculinity too. Like, you know, I tell my students all the time, patriarchy is bad for everyone. It's bad for everyone.
Exactly.
It's except for like the 1%. It is bad for men and women. And, you know, I always joke, I love men, but I fucking hate patriarchy. And that's what I tell them. Yep. Like, because I really deeply feel that it's bad for all of them in that room.
It is.
And I don't care what your gender identity is or your sex. I want you to see that those structural systems are bad for all of us. Unless you're the 1%. Unless you're like kind of the rich, white dude, or you're OJ, you know, having watched that 8 hours.
Right.
Like, I really feel like I watched how those ideas of masculinity and patriarchy and whiteness just messed with him. You know, that was the main argument of those 8 hours that ESPN did. But, you know, that's what I want. They want to talk about those things.
No, I agree.
They do.
No, and I think that, you know, something that, you know, we were talking about with the Olympics before, about maybe this, we're seeing this as, you know, we're watching stuff, the ways that we've dealt with questions of gender and things are collapsing at this point. Same thing we see with Trump, right? As you mentioned before.
I have so many things to say about
that. And you will definitely get to that. And,
yes.
And but you know, I was thinking about these points and markers, and you going back to 1996, right? When you know, as a point of comparison. And I was also thinking about, you know, what's interesting is that, you remember that movie Falling Down?
Michael Douglas? The guy like walking in and just like losing his stuff.
Exactly.
Because the world around him is failing him.
It's
the same thing.
Right. It's the white
guy.
This
is America.
Right?
Make America great again.
But exactly. But I think that if you think about this, right, as I was thinking about that as a timeline, is that in Falling Down, Michael Douglas's character, right, it's like, it was the first, well, I shouldn't say it's the first one, but it was speaking to that kind of anxiety. Like Death of a Salesman is also kind of the same kind of the trajectory here.
But now white male privilege crumbling. Yes.
Exactly. But now...
Because what flips him out is he can't get a sandwich at the time he wants it.
Exactly. Yes. Right? And like he's losing his job, right? Because it's closing down.
But the thing that finally flips him over in that movie is like, I can't get the sandwich I want at the time I want it, as if that's some great...
Right. And if you think about this, the rest of that film as just like the crazy kind of white privilege fantasy fear, right? It's like, you know, the sadomasochist garbage and all this.
Fight Club's exactly.
Right. Yeah. Fight Club's another one. But what's interesting is that then using, and then Donald Trump as that other point of cultural marker, right? It's at the point now where people are kind of saying, oh my God, this guy's off his rocker. Right. And so watching that arc, right.
I'm nodding passionately.
Yeah. And seeing it's very similar in terms of what we're seeing in gender and sexuality and
he
right across
so
the board.
He is so committed to binaries. And we can save that and talk about it later because I really do want to talk about that. But I think his stranglehold and desire to hold on to binaries, like literal walls and tests. Is exactly the opposite of what I'm seeing in my room, classrooms.
And this is exactly where my long segue or kind of diversion into this, right, is to say, you know, one of the things that Trump has staked his ground on is on this PC stuff, right?
And how are we talking about this again?
Well, but that's
it's
the thing.
Like I'm back in college in 1994. PC. No one has talked about that for 15 years, and suddenly we're talking about it again.
And I think that's the point. And I think that if you think about the rallying, like who's rallying around that, is that you're now having a shrinking group of people that is actually meaningful to.
Yes.
Whereas I have had the same experience with students in my class. If you call them out on certain things, right? And it's not like you call them out and say, like,
I'm not mean. Right. I'm not mean. Well, it's a tension thing I was thinking about. But like, I'm not mean about it.
No. But you're kind of calling attention. And what I find, again, very similar is that, well, students' response is like, oh, God, I didn't know that. Or hadn't thought about it like that they're not coming in this as feeling that something is being taken away from them. They're thinking like, oh, that's the last thing I'd want to do is like piss someone off or upset somebody. Right. That was not my intention. Right. And they're much more open to that. And I'll have to even what blew my mind last fall, the first time ever that I had, it was a first year composition class, is that I had a woman in that class using the language of cisgender.
Yeah, that's cool.
Right? As a way And which so that's gonna be so much. And, you know, again, you could see it in the classroom is that there was probably 4 or 5 students that understood what she was talking about, right?
Yes.
Most of it, I said, but that is like discourse that has circulated within, you know, Ivy League schools and intellectual
circles. We've been
trying
so hard.
Exactly.
Yes.
But, and to see that enter the classroom voluntarily right, was remarkable.
It is extraordinary that students are able to define their subject position so well.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. I think that when you introduce them to those words and that language, they're so ready to adopt it. And what I encourage them to do is change their Facebook status, their Facebook gender.
Mm-hmm.
So, because I'm like, go look on Facebook at the, like, I think it's 54 choices.
Mm-hmm.
Look at that. And that just doing that is so cool that you can do that. And they do. They're like, oh, that's so cool. Like, they really want to talk about language in ways that it's funny because one of the pieces that I've written recently was about the singular they and how I advocate for it.
And
like from very close friends, they're just like, I just hate the sound of this. I can't get used to it. And I'm like, I don't care. We've tried Z and Zim and we've tried all these things and nothing sticks.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have to go with the thing that is already there.
It's already there.
It has been proven that if we are going to make language inclusive, we're just going to have to let go of our like binary of right grammar and wrong grammar. And we're all going to have to deal with it if we're going to make space in our language. But even that, like, you know, I in that piece, I write about how when I used to grade papers in 1996, I would circle the mistake and be like, he is singular and they is plural. And now I just take a sip of coffee and move on because it's not an error to me anymore. Because I've evolved in my teaching because there have become gray areas in my life too. So, but it's just so cool when they know, that's what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They have the vocabulary already.
Yep.
They're coming to the class. And when it comes from them instead of me, it is so much more powerful. So when she does that and inserts that, and then when somebody does that in my class, I'm like, okay, so you just used a word that I'm guessing not a lot of folks know. Can you tell everybody what that means?
That's exactly what I did, yeah.
Exactly. Because mm-hmm. that's way more, to me, that's like feminist pedagogy, right? Like, it's not coming from me. It's that kind of constructivist, like, coming from them. And because that is going to matter in their worlds. It already does. But, like, in the ways that people talk about gender, they're so much better at it. They're so much better at it.
No, that's right. And you said something really important there. I think that is, you know, this is critical, I think, for, say, political pedagogy. And I don't mean it like politicized, like I'm going to try to force this down. But just what you said there is that, you know, you learned and grew as a teacher.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, there was this, I'm forgetting her name right now. She's an African-American woman. It was a video that circulated from The Guardian. And she was talking about grammar and grammar policing and how that is important in these kind of discussions. And one of the examples that she came up with is like, so one of my... Again, I don't go out and kind of correct students and all this. When I look at stuff like this, when I look at language, I mean, you know me. I come at things primarily at my first gloss is a class lens, right?
Yes.
So when I hear grammar, right, what I hear is class.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
So
and I grew up lower middle class, right? I mean that caused me great anxiety.
I looked around
and I was like, oh shit, I better learn how to talk like them. Because otherwise, I'm not going to get in this club. Anyway, keep going.
No, and one of the first things, and one of those ones that always stuck in my head, right, was the difference between less and few, right? And for whatever reasons, right, I didn't pay attention with all these other things, but for some reason, that's one of these things that stuck in my mind.
To you, that was a marker.
Yeah, it was a marker.
To me,
right?
It was who and whom.
And I started.
It was a marker.
Well, there you go, right? And so I started listening to, and for whatever reason, for the past like a few years, listening to a bunch of podcasts and all this stuff, I would get this point, and they would say, like less when it should be few.
Yes,
right?
Yes, I hear it too.
Right, and I was like, and it came up, and I'm like, it bothered me, and I'm like, what's bothering me? And then I saw this video. This woman comes up and says, like, think about it like this: when you're in the grocery line and they say 10 items or less, do you have a problem understanding that? And I'm like,
that's a good point. Yeah.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
Actually, I do not. And she's like, so what's the issue? And I think, you know, again, that's a kind of trivial example, but I think it's similar in that.
No, that's just like talking about the Olympics is not a trivial example, well, right? Very telling.
And it gets right to that thing when we're talking about, you know, that singular, talking about the singular they, right? Using that in sentences and saying some of it has to do with letting go of these kind of vestiges of privilege that we learn for those folks who are kind of, you know, at the, you know, the adult level or the parent level or the kind of, you know, professor level of saying, you know, maybe these things, the way that we've learned these things are problematic in and of themselves. So it's a constant learning on our part as well, I think.
Yes, we have to constantly learn. We have to evolve. I had to evolve. Things were different in 1996 when I started teaching.
Say it isn't so.
And all for the better. For the most part. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, so just one thing before we talk about the election, before we take a break for the election. So, if we kind of flip that around, we've talked a little about the education there in the classroom, what we're seeing from students. So, but, you know, the university is not simply just a classroom, right? Between a teacher, it's also a workplace, right?
Yes.
It's also, that's embedded with, all sorts of complications, right? And especially, but certainly when it comes to questions of gender and so on. I know that you're active in a whole range of issues, right?
Both
at the statewide level and also on our campus. So I'm kind of thinking, you know, as you switch out of the classroom and you're thinking about your role as a faculty member at the university and so, what's that experience kind of put before you in terms of like where we are now in kind of in connection with these discussions we've been having up until this point?
Something I think a lot about right now, just because I'm a faculty member who is dealing with promotion issues in this part of my academic career or my career, is thinking about the idea of the academy. And again, these ideas of gatekeepers of what counts, what doesn't count as scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there, and again, in this conversation, it comes back to what you were just talking about, that there's, I feel like these very limited ideas of what scholarship is, and those that scholarship is going to lead to a promotion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, the things that I write for Teaching Tolerance or the things that I write for other you know, peer-reviewed online sources are marginalized. Mm-hmm. And I think that especially women, I write those things because I want things to change. I write those things because I don't want to write for an academic journal that three other people are going to right. read. And exactly. honestly, I don't need to convince those people. Mm-hmm. I need to convince the larger audience. I need to be a better public intellectual than an academic scholar. I think those are the same thing, but I think that people are forcing, I think marginalized populations, right? I think people who write about class, people who want to write about gender, people who want to write about race, we want to change those things in a larger public way.
Right.
And when I write for a very specific audience that already thinks the same way that I do, I find that to be limiting and I don't want to do it. I feel like I have more at stake. I have more, not that those journals don't matter, but writing for a larger audience to me matters more. And to be in a, and I'm speaking about the academy in a capital A, in an academy that devalues that kind of writing, mm-hmm. that holds me back from the material consequence of promotion.
Right.
Because what I'm doing is does not, again, fit into that tiny little box of what scholarship is. To me, that's a feminist issue. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I really try to push back against in going up for promotion. And I see that women on our campus don't feel like they can go up for promotion. And I have conversations with women that I think going up for full is a political act at this point on the campus.
Yep.
When so many fewer women are full, you know, and Black women or women of any marginalized race is even less. And it's right. it is to me at this point, and I think those numbers are not because those women. It's not because I am less ambitious. But it is because my ambition doesn't fit into what a patriarchal, white, mostly male system of the 50s or whatever still is that gatekeeper. And I want one thing I want to do on our campus and all campuses is broad, and I know you're doing this too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is to broaden the understanding of what scholarship is. That the things that I write take just as much time. Mm-hmm. And I think they have a lot at stake. And if I'm going to spend my precious, right, because there are material reasons, right? Like I have a kid. I live far from work. Yep. I have yep. students. I don't have all day to write. So in the precious few hours a week that I have to write, I want to write things that I think matter for an audience that I think matters. And to me, that's, you know, that's something that I think about a lot on our campus is who's getting to make these decisions, who's deciding what scholarship is, and I talk about it with my students too. I want them to see that even though I'm a fancy professor now and I'm the director of women's studies and gender studies, that there are people who still will say to me, yeah, that doesn't really count.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of counting
yep.
is that I don't get to define what counts is very, that's not empowering to me.
Right. Well, and I would add to that, and I would say that, you know, this is kind of goes into kind of like the dual directions of doing any kind of, say, political work. Like on the one hand, you're thinking about what's the effectivity of my work going to be, right? So if I actually care about these ideas and actually moving something for change, right? Then I maybe have to think about different venues, right?
Yes.
Is that three people I'm running for in this journal actually going to accomplish that or no? So that's one direction. On the other hand, too, I do think it's kind of what you were saying before about having to kind of push back at the institutions too as well, because, you know, and we were talking about this beforehand too, is like, I think that as embedded in these processes, it's not just what counts, right? But it's also how they view the person, right?
Yeah.
How they take, for example, artifacts, right, that are looking for promotion, and are they viewing those the same if that person is a man versus
absolutely
a woman?
Not. Because, absolutely not.
And the example
in our department, the people that have been denied promotion have been women.
Well, and this is the example I was going to get.
Because it's confusing. Because what we do is confusing, it is transdisciplinary, and it doesn't fit in a box. That has been the reason that has been given all of us.
Well, exactly. And I also think that what that comes out of, and the case that I have in my mind, and I'm not going to name names at this point, but it's like, for example, is that there's someone who does very similar work than I do. I recently got promoted, and she, by any objective measure,
absolutely,
right, has done more publishing than I've done. That's and I'm not sitting here, I'm not trying to like knock myself. That's not the point. The point is that is she has done more work objectively than I have.
Yes.
Right. At a national level, at a scholarship level, and even at service, right? I mean, I've been obviously blah blah blah. And she didn't get promoted and I got promoted.
Because the work is marginalized.
Well,
marginalized.
That's true, but here's the case.
It was like, well, this isn't really a thing.
Right.
Well, yes, it is a thing.
But you know
because
what?
Because this is how the world works now.
Right, but exactly. And here's the thing. Here's the thing exactly with that is that there were, if you look at my promotion package next to her promotion package, there were similar items on mine that somehow were magically considered a thing and they weren't for her.
Yes.
And that has everything to do with then that level of perception about what's the gendered lens through which
exactly.
They're being
racist. And I'm not sitting here saying that I think there are men in a back room, like insidiously hatching and planning. And I know you're not saying that either, but I have to say that all the time is that these are deeply embedded structural and ideological ideas at play. It is not that someone is looking at me and saying, you're a woman, so your work matters less.
Right.
What I am saying is that there is an ideological concept of what scholarship is and that needs to flex and bend and change, just like everything else is flexing and bending and changing.
Yep.
So to me, 100%. that's something that I really I'm Kutz Town's delegate to the PASHI Women's Consortium. We're hosting the conference this year, and I'm the chair of the conference, but also I'm the chair of the LVAIC, the Lehigh Valley Association of Independent Colleges, undergraduate conference. You know, I do all these things because I want to bring women faculty together so they can talk and we can talk about how to change this. Our union and the Women's Studies and Gender Studies program and a bunch of other folks are sponsoring a women's faculty luncheon. I was the first person that wrote back to the invitation and made the joke, so when's the men's luncheon? Because I knew it was going to come, so I wanted to be the first one. But there is an important element of, and I'm on the status of on the Commission of Women, like these are specific conversations that need to be had. They're a specific population. It's not, again, I don't think it's insidious. It's just that it's a place and it has a structure. And so therefore it has an ideology. I want to see women who want to succeed. I don't think women are less ambitious on our campus. I think that they're just doing the service, which is marginalized. I think they're publishing for different venues, which is marginalized. And it's, again, if I weren't doing all that service and I could spend all that time writing peer review articles for peer review journals, then that's fine. But I'm not vested in that politically and personally. So I think that's what I want to see I want there to be many different avenues and different ways for women to also be recognized. I don't want my work to be told, I don't want to be told my work doesn't count, which I've been told. To my face, my work doesn't count. Like, this work doesn't count. What do you mean this doesn't count? I'm making sure specifically post-colonial women are being inserted into a traditionally male, white-dominated publication for the last 50 years.
Tell me why that doesn't count in the kind of...
How does that not count? How does, like, helping a group make editorial choices and ensuring that those women, writers, are being represented, how does that not count? So those things are what drive me bonkers on campus. I mean, those are the things that keep me up at night. When I hear that my female colleagues, women colleagues are not being promoted because the work they were asked to do by the university was transdisciplinary, so it didn't fit into that little tiny peg of what she was supposed to do. Or this journal she wrote for isn't really a good journal. And then there's this magic list that we're all supposed to know about. You know, these are why is it women that keep having to have these conversations? Or me, you can't go up for promotion because you had a baby.
Yep.
And I'm like, I'm ready to go up for promotion. Why do you get to decide? Take my stuff and determine it on that instead of making a decision because I had a kid. So it's just, you know, or somebody who on our campus once stopped the clock because when she had her baby, didn't benefit her in a way, or not benefit, but like when she had her baby, kind of didn't stop her clock at all the way that it did mine for a semester.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, why don't we have these things? So these are the constant conversations I'm having on our campus.
You know, and this is the point, too. And this is when people start going into their corners about, you know, and this goes right back to a point that you made before about, you know, patriarchy is bad for everyone.
Yes.
Right? And in some sense, I'm even hesitant, you know, because I'm not trying to say, well, let's just make these equivalences and stuff. But this is kind of like a perfect example of this. And I think that any political work, right, is always suffers from this double burden. Right. And the idea that is that we recognize, for example, patriarchy is bad for everybody. Right. But somehow, right, it's mostly women who are doing, having the work to stop that. And as part of that argument, right, unlike what we saw, you know, I've read all these stuff. And I always remember the stuff by Frantz Fanon, for example.
Yeah.
It talks about horizontal violence. Right.
Yeah.
That is that if what you've experienced always has been this kind of system of oppression and violence, is that there's that temptation is that once you've gained power to then to do exactly that. But like feminism, right, kind of like socialism, a whole range of other things has been on the principle that, no, it's actually, it's this double burden. It's just saying, no, we want to get rid of that thing and we don't want to then there turn around and become an oppressor.
That's why I developed my Women in Violence class.
That's awesome.
Right? Because I wanted to, so in that class, everybody assumes it's all texts about women who are victims of violence and that all the texts are women who are perpetrators of violence. And so that we can talk about how women who are violent too. And I joke with them. I'm like, I don't want to hear, oh, if women ruled the world, it would be peaceful. I don't believe in this authentic idea. Like you're talking about, I don't want,
yep.
My feminism is not then I want women all in power because I think they're inherently better. I want us to have conversations about how people who are in power can work together
exactly.
To make things more egalitarian. I am not interested in a women run, like I'm not supporting Hillary Clinton because she's a woman. I'm smart enough to know a vagina doesn't automatically make you better.
Right.
But that is exactly that double burden of like, why do I have to explain this to you?
No.
But it is, but it's just the easy, quick way to try to debunk.
No,
me.
But exactly.
Yeah.
And one of the ways I think, you know, I think about this about, say the micro negotiations, right? About how this is, right? This stuff needs to be conversations in the everyday. And the example I was thinking about in this, you know, relation to having a kid, right? So I had someone in our department who was about to have a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's after I had two.
Mm-hmm.
It was a guy and he came to me and he said, hey, I was just wondering if I could ask you just some questions about, you know, that experience. You know, it was a first time father and things like this. And I said to him, I said, okay, listen, you gotta know a few things right up front. Right. Is that if I've learned anything, I've learned this. Number one, right, that you're going to start feeling the pressure very quickly, right, as a guy, right, that is to say that, okay, you've had your kid, right, and yeah, we know that maybe your first semester is going to be rough, right, but then you're going to get back and kind of get back to things,
mm-hmm.
right? So you're going to fear that pull,
mm-hmm.
right? And the thing that you have to decide, right, is what kind of relationship do you want? What kind of parent do you want to be, right? And then how do you kind of renegotiate all these things?
Yeah.
Is it because the pressure is going to be is to sock you back into that role where your wife is going to be the one that's going to take care of that
They
kid.
Assume. The assumption is. The assumption is that there's somebody at home.
Exactly.
I always joke, I need a wife, right?
Yeah,
but
exactly.
The assumption is that there's a wife
that's
kind of
always,
taking care of the home
always,
front for
always
you.
The assumption.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I remember that kind of being like, oh, okay. And then he came back to me about a year later and said, you were right.
Yeah, wow.
And I said, yeah. And it's those kind of things that I think, you know, this is, goes right to your point, is that when we're talking about getting rid of these, you know, get rid of patriarchy, right, is because it impacts everybody differentially.
Absolutely.
And so say, for example, if that person, right, came and then said, was never thinking about this stuff and succumbed to the pressure of saying, okay, now I'm going to get back in this role of like, you know, my wife's going to have to handle it because I've got to do this job, then that just kind of reinforces the entire structure all over again. So it's great. Well, you brought up Hillary, and so we're going to have to close out today pretty soon, actually. But we're going to have to close out today. We're going to take a little bit of a break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about the election, the Woo-hoo! Joy that Woo-hoo! Is this election. All right? This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. This is The Sit Down. We'll be back right after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1949. That was the day that is remembered as Kemi Bloody Thursday in Finland. Two strikers were killed. Kemi is a lumber town in northern Finland. The lumber workers in the area went out on strike when the government proposed slashing their wages by more than 30%. The strike was soon joined by sawmill and dock workers. The walkout caused a massive logjam on the Kemijoki River. On the fateful day, 3,000 strikers engaged in a peaceful march. They encountered armed police, and a confrontation ensued. Police had guns on their side. The workers only had sticks and stones. One striker was shot and killed. Another was hit by a truck. Finnish army troops were called into Kemi. 32 strike leaders were arrested. In response to the violence, sympathy strikes were called by other unions, including the Seamen's Union. These strikes were seen by many as a fight between the Finnish elected government and communists in the nation's trade unions. Officials in the United States worried the strikes were an attempt by the communists to open the door to intervention in Finland by the Soviet Union. After World War II, Cold War politics shaped responses to labor struggles in many nations. A song, Fly Black-Winged Bird, remembers the fallen workers. The lyrics, translated into English, began, Fly, black-winged bird, with blood on your feathers across the lands. From village to village, carry your message. Open up, autumn sky, for the sad news to spread. Shame on a country where an unarmed man gets shot. Shame on the one who calls the shots. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Sit Down. This is Kevin Mahoney. I'm the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, and I'm here today with Colleen Clemens. So Colleen, I guess the best intro into this last segment is just to say Trump.
Yeah. So here is what I've been continually waiting for is the moment that his misogyny finally backfires. And the fact that it never did is a very telling thing to me. That I can be behind cars that have stickers that say Trump that bitch. Mm-hmm. And if you would imagine the analog of that, using a racial slur about Barack Obama, mm-hmm. and how not okay that would be.
Right.
But that somehow it's still okay for people to put things like that on their cars is astounding to me. Mm-hmm. And the fact that that his misogynistic comments have not imploded his candidacy is very telling to me. Mm-hmm. That one of those things that he has said over the course of time should have been enough. And what I think is interesting now is that he's taking on feminism, and he's using Muslim women. He's deploying Muslim women as a way to, this is very common in rhetoric, to, and the Bush era, they did it as well. Exactly. Suddenly after 9/11, everybody cared about Afghan women. And
the
they
first
were
Iraq
used,
war too as well. Right?
Yes. Right. Print, yeah. Yes. So it was suddenly, you know, so what Trump has been saying is, you know, these honor killings, and this is happening in our borders. And so now he's deploying a bastardized version of a discussion about women's rights for his own use. And I just think it's fascinating that this is happening again, and that people are still buying into this as if Muslim women have no agency and Donald Trump is going to be the one that protects them. And the only way we can protect our women and our children from Sharia law, for example, is to close our borders and make tests, and again, to shrink as opposed to expand. I mean, I don't really even have that much to say about him, because I sit with my mouth hanging agape, mm-hmm. at some of the things that I hear him say from a misogynistic standpoint, that I was always going to vote for Hillary. I voted for her in the primary against Barack years ago.
I did too.
Years ago.
I said we needed a fighter, not someone who wants to kind of...
You know, and I love that my daughter has grown up with Barack Obama as her first mm-hmm. president. And I hope my daughter grows up with Hillary Clinton as her second president. Not because she's a woman, though I think it is powerful for my daughter to see a black man and then a white woman. You know, her conception of presidency as a concept will be different than what I grew up as. I don't want her to be president. you know, that what I am concerned about is how women come up only when they are convenient. Mm-hmm. And this idea of deploying women's issues as an opportunity to show that you are strong is, I am so sick of it. And I'm so sick of it. I'm so sick of watching it. Hillary Clinton has actually been talking about women and women in the mm-hmm. world, excuse me, for decades.
Yep.
For decades. I show videos to my class, just movies and things, that they're, and I'm not, and I'll be like, they'll be like, oh, Hillary Clinton was in that. Like, yes, because she was talking about this in 1997. She stood in front of the UN and said, women's rights are human rights.
Yep.
That was extraordinary. That has been part of her conversation and her rhetoric forever. Yep. It is part of who she is. And that is why I like her.
So let me ask you this. So we didn't talk about this ahead of time, but I'm curious your take on this. Because the one thing that's bothered me about this entire campaign, mm-hmm. right? I mean, echo everything you just said about Trump. And we could pile on this, yeah. right? Because this guy is incredible. And we could add on to that the fact that so few Republicans have broken from him,
yes.
right? That you still have Pat Toomey right here in Pennsylvania basically coming yes. out again and, you know, marginally didn't come out and kind of like give him a big hug, but he's certainly sitting there as you can say he's going to support him. So even putting that right in that Trump camp, what's bothered me more than anything else, if we look at the past 8 years, there's been a virtual war on women, women's health, women's rights,
oh my God.
All
abortion.
Across this country.
Oh, my God.
Right? And it was front and center for a long
Mike
time
Pence.
In the media. And it has been virtually absent in the presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean, I mean, Hillary, now look, if I want to be clear. Hillary,
yeah.
there's a lot of reasons why Hillary wouldn't be out there spearheading all this kind of stuff. And we could talk about
that. Because she doesn't have to.
Well, she doesn't have
to.
And
she'll immediately be a target. If she's the one that brings it up, she's going to be the target.
Right, exactly. So I want to be careful because I've heard some people say this. They say, why hasn't Hillary done this? I said, no. Why hasn't the Democratic Party been doing this? If you have Hillary Clinton out there, and like again, I think a lot of good pressure was put on Bernie Sanders, right? Both on the race question and on the gender question, right? And they put I was a strong Bernie supporter, but he still didn't move to where I wanted him to be on those things. But we even put that aside. Mm-hmm. Where was the Democratic Party in that conversation? And I'm curious. I'm wondering if this is something that they're going to pull out for the general. Right, as we've got to move forward with the debates, are we finally going to see the Democrats going full throttle? So, I mean, and I don't mean just Elizabeth Warren, right? But the Democrats going full throttle at this guy. I'm just curious your take on that.
Trump,
or and the kind or of like why have we not seen women's issues like the war on women front and center
yeah.
in this campaign?
Well,
so
because
far?
I think Hillary has never been able to figure out which target she's supposed to hit. Right. So she in, you know, when she was running against Obama, she was supposed to be masculine and she was supposed people thought she was shrill and she was. And so now she softened and there was so much rhetoric about mothering and grandmothering during the DNC. And I just think she has no idea there. The target just keeps moving. And I think that's probably why, because she's probably still really she's not gun shy to talk about women's issues. But she's definitely deploying, like, Planned Parenthood. I mean, there are these people who are speaking about it, and it's not her. Because I think the target just keeps moving. I mean, here's a woman who came up poor, who went to college, who made money, who stayed by her philandering husband, who did all the things that in theory a woman is supposed to do. Just like Barack Obama, right? All the things that according to that narrative, you're supposed to do. And yet they are the two most demonized people.
Yep.
But somebody who has had many wives, a Newt Gingrich, a Donald Trump, how, again, this is privilege, right? How can they dodge the bullets over and over? That's a bad metaphor. But, like, how can they dodge it over and over again?
It's incredible.
And it's because of privilege. Mm-hmm. It's because of privilege. So I think Hillary has been policed and policed, and she is not going to bring that stuff up until she has to.
No, right. And I
because that is the rabbit hole for her.
I agree.
Then it will be, forget it. All you care about is women. It's the same reason Barack Obama didn't talk about black issues until like year seven. Yeah.
Well,
because
I would say,
he didn't want to be seen as the black president.
That's right.
Which I understand.
But I would say that I would even say that Hillary has been more out in front of women's issues in this campaign, right? I think than Barack Obama was on race issues, right?
And it's 100%. Absolutely.
And it's
I agree with that.
So I would give her, I don't want to minimize like how much she has been inserting kind of women's rights into this. And she's talked very good about women's labor. She's talked about about parental leave stuff, a whole bunch of stuff. Right?
The fact that was mentioned in her speech was incredible.
Right. So I want to be clear about that. But it, you know, in my mind, and this is my call for all those Democrats out there listening, right? It's time for, you know, don't look to Hillary for this. I think it's time for the Democrats, the Democratic Party, right, people to kind of go after this. And I think that, you know, we're starting to see some of that. First of all, Cecile Richards is always the best person in my mind in the world on this stuff.
Yes.
I love her to pieces. She's incredible. But she's been one person who's been very pointed on that. And now NARAL has been coming. I don't know if you saw this. They've got these great GIFs that are out there.
No, I haven't.
There's these. I'll have to send you a link for this, and we'll put it on the show notes. It's basically, it puts them in this car. I guess it comes out of a movie. I'm not very good in popular culture. Sorry, folks. But it's from a movie. But they replace all the heads. There's Donald Trump, and then you have Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, and then they swap out the heads of different senators in different states. So here's Pat Toomey, right? Basically puts them all in the same car and say, you guys are all riding together, right? It's not just Trump, right?
Oh, no.
You people have been doing this for decades.
Well, this is why in our district, I'm supporting Vera Cole and why I'm actively trying to get her elected, because she's talking about mass incarceration, right? Like she's talking about race. And she's talking about climate change. And she's talking about these things that are supposedly taboo. And I mean, honestly, just the fact that somebody's talking in a campaign about mass incarceration and how that negatively affects marginalized populations, that's not extraordinary, but sadly it is.
Right.
Sadly it is. And this is why I'm, you know, I look around and I want to support people who can stand in front of a town hall or in front of the UN and talk about human rights and equality. And I wouldn't have voted for Michelle Bachmann. I'm not voting for somebody just because she's a woman. That is so that's such a diminishing statement to me. I like that she's a woman, but it's not why I'm voting for her.
No, exactly. And I would say, and we were talking a little about this before, is that, you know, for me, as someone who, like, you know, worked and, you know, campaigned for Bernie and this kind of stuff, was never a doubt in my mind that, you know, if we support him, obviously if he got the nomination, I would have been happy. But at the same time,
I would have happily voted for him.
Well, that's it. And I say, when I look at that and I say that he was able to push the agenda of the Democratic Party more than I have seen in my entire lifetime so far. Someone who followed politics since I was 10 years old. And that has been the enormous victory of this whole campaign. But there's no question in my mind ever. It's like once this comes out, then again, there's no way I'm putting a Republican in. I don't care who the hell it was. I don't care if it was Donald Trump or whatever, after what they've been doing for the past 30 years. But if that wasn't enough, I mean, there's a story I told you before, was that we went to Washington, D.C., just a visit because I love D.C. and we went and did all the touristy things. And my kids each wanted a ruler, right? It was a kind of a ruler with all the presidents on them and things like this. And they kind of dig politics too as well, right? And I'm sitting there one morning with my daughter, and my son hadn't gotten up yet, and we're getting ready for school. I'm sitting there at breakfast, and we're chit chatting about stuff. And she's looking at a ruler, and she says, "Daddy, where's all the girls?" Right? And I'm like, "Well, you know the answer to that," because she does it. She's like, "Hillary!" Right? You know what she's for.
Yep.
And for me, it's like, you know, again, and they have been following this, all my Bernie stuff and all this kind of stuff. But that, for example, for her to recognize that was so important. And, you know, it echoes things like, you know, we're reading the Magic Treehouse books, right? And the little girl in the Magic Treehouse books, Annie, she gets pissed off when they go back in time and women are excluded from things. And you see how young she is, 4 years old. She's recognizing already that she's looking at a sea of white guys, right? And one African-American guy, right? And asking the question, where is a woman? So, you know, and I always come back to that and say representation matters.
Absolutely.
Right? And again, I go back to what you said. Doesn't mean that it trumps absolutely everything in the world, right? Obviously, you've got some right-wing nut job.
Right.
As a
I
woman,
wasn't going to vote for Carly Fiorina. I would have never voted for Michelle Bachmann or Elizabeth Dole.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. Because we know that. as to kind of close this out, so our, you know, as you're looking forward in this election, as horrific as Donald Trump has been, you got any optimism about this?
I have a ton of optimism. Yeah. I wrote probably the most popular piece on my blog is the piece I wrote about why I think Donald Trump is a good sign.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think he is a caricature of the last gasp of all the things that I want to see implode. And I think the fact that he's only doing well with white males is so incredibly telling, and that this country isn't that anymore. So to me, when I look at him, and I say in there, you know, if he gets elected, we're going to have to talk. But I am heartened by the fact that no one is buying it. Like, most of the people I know are not buying it. And if I'm behind somebody with a Trump sticker, I'm like, okay, really? Now, if I'm behind a Trump that bitch sticker, my blood is boiling because that is not okay.
Mm-hmm.
It is not okay to do that. And it was just sounds like all the merchandising and everything was just that Trump that bitch, get that no bitches in the White House.
Yep.
You know, this kind of thing. They're gendering it, not me.
That's right. That's right. And they're kind of like, I do hope this is the at least, if not the last nail, a very substantial nail in the coffin of this. Because
I'm
this
hoping
is,
it's the last gasp.
You know, because I remind myself as I drive my kids to school every day and I go by these houses and there's three Trump signs out in front of these houses, right? Right on 4th Street. I remind myself, it says, yep, these are the people that when it comes to election day, then you remember you're going to be on the margins. Because even here in Pennsylvania, who is it's always a toss-up state, you got Hillary Clinton leading by double digits in the polls, and she's got a substantial lead in all the kind of the key states. So I hope, not only do I hope that this election is going to bring Hillary Clinton to the White House, I hope in this election it's going to be a landslide. And then
me
we
too.
Can really start to see some major change. Well, Colleen, I know you got to get running. Thank you so much for hanging out here today.
Thanks.
And
this was fun.
We hope to have you back on this. Right?
I can't wait. After the election, please invite me back.
But you know, but after the election, right? Everything's going to be solved, right?
Yeah.
We don't gender issues anymore.
No. We'll need to talk about the gender issues of what it's like to have a woman president.
All right.
Job security.
There you have it. All right. This is Kevin Mahoney. This has been The Sit Down. This is a project of Raging Chicken Radio. I am Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be back to you probably next week. Yes, indeed, because we're back on our regular track with our weekly episodes of The Sit Down. Don't forget to tune in to Out to Coop, which comes out every Thursday too as well. We're going to keep you up to date on some of the changes and schedules that we're going to have because I am back to work in about 2 weeks and we're going to have to figure out how we're going to produce all this stuff. So thanks for all tuning in, and don't forget to check out the show notes. We'll have links to Colleen's blogs and her articles and all sorts of cool stuff. We'll see you real soon. See ya!